This week's podcast from Jake the Writer, retired travel journalist, author, freelance writer and commentator, dips into his memory bank and relates his experience with Murphy's Law. If anything can go wrong, it probably will. I call it possibly our first Jolly Boys outing. 1983 was the year of the loads of money generation. Margaret Thatcher, in the glow of the Falklands War triumph, gave the Conservative Party a landslide victory and wiped the floor with Michael Foot, turning the political map of the country blue. Microsoft had launched the world's best word processing program called Microsoft Word. Cruise missiles appeared at Greenham Common along with large numbers of protesters. Droughts in Ethiopia caused the death of 4 million people, which gave Bob Geldof a great money-making idea. I owned a garage at that time and belonged to a group of local businessmen in Bedford, who, among other things, sponsored the Bedford Boys Boxing Club with some great events. The group seemed fairly evenly divided between motor dealers and estate agents, with the odd shopkeeper, accountant and a few solicitors. If the devil should cast his net. The subdivision of car dealers, motor traders and garage owners developed further into a dining, drinking and general entertainment group, and we organised a night out when we took over a local nightclub for the evening with a caterer, bar and entertainment laid on. It was that night out when the comedian came on and looked around the room and said, "Bedford Motor Crooks," and our group was christened. Bedford Boys Boxing Club was already quite famous, not least because British and British Commonwealth heavyweight champion Joe Bugner began his career here as an amateur before turning professional in 1967. The club had a long history of providing an evening of top quality amateur boxing, hosting clubs from all over the country. Anyway, Bedford Motor Crooks had a table of 10 to wine and dine and watch some great amateur boxing events. After the bouts came to an end and cigars were lit, the tradition was that a large number of items donated by local businesses were auctioned off. The more the wine flowed, the more generous the bidding came, with all of the profits going to the club. I can remember when one local entrepreneur took off his Rolex watch in a drunken gesture to donate to the cause, and even more inebriated bidding fetched about £1,000 more than the new value of the watch. That sets the scene. At our table, one of the motor traders said that he had just bought a top-of-the-range Winnebago motorhome, or as the Americans call it, a recreational vehicle. It could accommodate all 10 of us, and how did we feel about an outing? After a lot of discussion, we unanimously decided that it was a great idea and we would all pile in 2 weeks' time, sharing expenses and go to watch the Le Mans 24-hour race. The talk went something like this. "It's only 450 miles, that's nearer than Glasgow." Quite a few of us went to car auction in Glasgow on a regular basis. "It's only just the other side of Paris, a piece of cake." "Sort of 10 hours driving plus time on the ferry. Let's take it easy and allow 3 days to get there, 1 day for the race and 2 or 3 days back. Perfect." A few days before we were due to depart, I got my first view of our holiday home. What an eye-opener. It was the biggest motorhome I'd ever seen. Think 40 feet long, near double-decker bus size with a ladder up to the roof. A huge air conditioning unit on the roof next to an enormous generator. In the centre, on one side of this juggernaut, was an annex that powered out once the vehicle was parked up and it retreated flush to the side to go on the road. There were, as promised, separate bedrooms, some with bunks sufficient to sleep 10 people comfortably. shower room and toilet, a built-in television and VHS player. Remember, this was 1983. All of the furnishings included a cocktail cabinet, were unbelievably luxuriously finished and would have put some luxury liner's cabins to shame. In 2016, a similar vehicle would cost in excess of £250,000. Come departure day, all of us were excited about our luxury holiday and we met up at our agreed meeting point. The first unplanned glitch. Strike one. Think 10 people arriving at an airport with their check-in luggage plus carry-on bags, enough to fill a carousel. Right, not a problem. Someone has to climb up the ladder and stack all the luggage on the roof rack next to the aircon unit and the generator. It's the middle of English summer, so of course it's raining. This turned into what the Special Forces call a Chinese parliament, with the difference that an SAS patrol is usually just four men, and we all had 10 offering their opinions. One of the gang disappeared to his business premises for a large tarpaulin to cover our luggage, and I went off to buy some straps to tie everything down. 2 hours later, the cases were snugly secured and we set off. Naturally, by this time it had stopped raining. Strike two. This was a few years before the M25 opened, and before we got as far as the ferry, one of the guys worked out that we're only doing 4 miles to the Gallum. Thank goodness that petrol, yes, it was a petrol engine, not diesel, cost around £1.70 a gallon. Those were the days. Strike three. Because of our size, we had to load with the lorries and couldn't get on the next ferry, so we were delayed for another 1.5 hours, but at least we were in pole position for the next ferry. Time for a meal. Getting back in good time to board. We had left the air conditioning running on our luxury abode and first in line for the lorries to load. The engine refused to turn over. The air conditioning had flattened the positively enormous bank of batteries. 10 motor crooks were unable to bump start the beast. No one in the queue behind had a tow rope, but with the help of a couple of lorry drivers, we were able to push the monster out of the line. Did you know that motor crooks swear worse than sailors? Another 10-man Chinese parliament decided that we should camp for the night where we were. Not much option to that, really, and in using the onboard generator overnight to charge the batteries. Strike four. After an hour charging with everything switched off except a couple of small wall lights and the battery indicator showing good signs of life, the generator stopped. Examination proved that it had run out of fuel. Another Chinese parliament decided that we didn't have a tube to siphon fuel from the brute, and in any case the generator ran on two-stroke mixture. A volunteer was dispatched to the nearest garage to buy a can of two-stroke fuel. Better, buy two cans in case we need the generator in France. Our volunteer finally returned, having had to get a taxi to travel miles to find an open garage with the necessary fuel, and we in due course got the generator running and the batteries charging. We managed about 4 hours sleep before we woke to check over the vehicle and make sure that everything was working properly. Took up a position to load onto the ferry. Thank goodness I didn't have to drive that juggernaut up the ramp and into position on the loading deck. Strike five. No 10-man discussion this time, but somebody decided that while we were at sea, we should run the generator to really top up the batteries. Breakfast. And then, halfway across the channel, the ship's tannoy demanded that we'd return to our vehicle. Oh my word, surely nothing else could go wrong. When we got to our vehicle, we found an irate crew member jumping up and down, pointing to our generator and shouting, "Das ist verboten!" I'm not sure if he was French or English, but he sounded like a Nazi. He was abusive enough to upset several of our barrack room lawyers among our number, one of whom insisted on being taken to see the captain to complain of his rude and abusive behaviour. Because we were such a bloody-minded lot, we left the generator running and had fully charged the battery by the time we'd docked. We drove off and parked up to wait for our representative. He returned, having had his apology. It turned out the captain, ever such a nice chap, was a fellow Freemason. Strikes 6, 7, and 8. Nothing else could go wrong other than a puncture just before we got to Paris. The monster had 10 wheels in total, and it only took 10 motor crooks around 2.5 hours to work out where the spare wheel was hidden, and then work out where the jack was. How were we to know that it didn't look like a jack, just a 3-foot-long piece of metal with a ratchet along its length on one side? Then when we finally charged the wheel and found that the tyre was soft, not flat, just a bit soggy, and we had to drive slowly to a service area. Aire de service, where we blew up the tyre and checked the others. Then in view of our history, we took our 2 fuel cans to get them filled up with 2-stroke mixture for the generator, while we topped up the ginormous fuel tanks. Use your imagination. 10 English motor dealers with various educations attempting to explain that we wanted 2-stroke fuel for the generator by pointing to the roof of the Winnebago. No, we didn't need the air conditioning topping up, thank you. Eventually, we just filled the 2 cans with 2-star, and unbelievably, one of the guys went into the shop to get a coffee, and bingo, he found a can of 2-stroke oil. We left the Boulevard Pirafique in Paris, turned onto the A11 when the engine began to overheat. After finding somewhere safe to park, 10 garage owners stroke motor traders, car salesmen stroke dealers and a motor auctioneer checked the cause of the overheating. You will have heard the adage about the number of people needed to change a light bulb. Well, I can tell you that it takes 10 motor crooks to find a small leak in the top radiator hose. We could wrap some tape tightly around it as a temporary measure, if we had some tape. We didn't. Eventually, somebody found some baling twine and a plastic carrier bag, and we strapped it up and refilled the radiator from our onboard water tank, and we trundled off as far as the next service area, where we stopped in a cloud of steam. We resumed our struggle with schoolboy French to the staff, who again responded by their now routine blank faces. I then gained Superman status by solving the problem, by asking 2 coppers, who I saw were sitting in their car drinking coffee. They didn't even leave their car, but 30 minutes later, a mechanic arrived in a breakdown truck, took away our defective top hose, and within an hour returned with a replacement. He fitted it, refilled our drinking water tanks, and checked our tyres, and we were on our way. The bill from the mechanic was 500 francs. That's less than £50. My pals were slapping me on the back and congratulating on the way I'd charmed the old bill, and then began hooting when I explained that I'd sorted the problem out in the time-honoured way. I bunged them a pony. That's £25, or in fact, 250 francs, and it worked like a charm. 2 hours later, we pulled into the Le Mans track, the campsite, just as it was getting dark. The fairground was in full swing with a huge Ferris wheel and lights and loud music. Our millionaire recreation vehicle, with its centre extension pulled out, really looked the business and was the centre of attention. Strike 9. Once settled, the party started. Our cocktail bar had been well stocked before we left, but we had also made a few stops on the way down. Well, we were in France, and as well as a 6-case of Courvoisier cognac, we had added a case of Moët en Chandon champagne and 3 cases of Premier Cru wine. The word went around the raceway, and more than a dozen new friends, including some fellow campers, a couple of race mechanics, and obviously the mention of free booze, a couple of journalists appeared. I hadn't mentioned that our 10 motor crooks, as well as being boxing aficionados, were all members of a local rowing club, and all of us were ex-rugby players, so we knew how to party. I sat quietly with a bottle of Premier Cru and a personal bottle of Courvoisier. I'm not sure if it was me that began singing a few rugby songs. It could have been. Some of our new German friends joined in with German lyrics to the same tunes. Then some of the French lads joined in their own language, and the night went on and on and on. I don't recall when the actual race started. It's around 3 p.m, but we all missed it. I think I fell asleep on the floor of the motorhome, but I woke lying up on the grass in hot sunshine and could hear the race engines, but I dozed off again. I woke up in the dark with the fairground in full swing with lots of lights and lots of noise. I decided to go back to the Winnebago for coffee and would then go to the race. Inside the motorhome, there were quite a few people slumped around. I made myself a coffee and sat on a sofa alongside one of the journalists from last night, who had also missed the start. Although a long while ago, I can still remember him starting to giggle and saying, "I know the tune and most of the words. I'll just put them together in time for the deadline." And he fell asleep again. I'm not sure when or how, but I woke up in my own bunk, in my own sleeping bag. Result? I think all or most of the guys were in their beds and someone was using the shower. So I went outside and across to use the campsite shower, which were excellent, as you may expect of France. It was there I learned that we had not only missed the start, but also the finish and the closing ceremony. I got back to the motorhome and found all present. When I passed on the news that although we hadn't planned to watch the free practice or the qualifying, we had come all of this way and missed every part of the 24-hour race itself. One of the guys said, "Bugger, I knew why they call it an endurance race," and we all collapsed, giggling like a bunch of schoolgirls. We decided that we weren't in a fit state to leave until the following morning, so our journey home would only take 2 days. That evening, we would go over and have an evening at the fair. But when we got there, it was closed and in the process of being dismantled. And we fell about laughing again. We found a good restaurant and had an excellent meal, sans alcohol. Strike 10. We had a perfect drive home, and for some reason our fuel consumption improved to over 7 miles a gallon. We drove unhindered straight onto the ferry and had a lovely drive home. One of the crooks owned a local car auctions, and a couple of weeks later he had the Winnebago valeted and detailed and advertised it nationally with some sort of story behind it. Not the real one, I might add. The millionaire recreational vehicle made a handsome profit for both the owner and the car auctions. Between them, they covered the whole kitty for our holiday, including my bung to the old bill. Who says my memory's getting bad? Some things are unforgettable. Do you know that I've been to motor races all over the world, but I've never seen the Le Mans 24-hour endurance race? Thanks for listening. I'll see you again next week.